Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 29, 2015. Residents of Pibor say they don't have enough drinking water.
People have gone to wash their clothes and the children are just defecate there. The kettle are drinking water there. The water is not okay.
And University of Juba holds its first graduation ceremony since independence.
It was really very challenging to deal with the family and work as an aim at this crucial moment where South Sudan is having a lot of problems, especially in the conflict management. This experience will help me really to help my people and my community as well as South Sudan at large.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. As the people of Pibor town gradually return to their homes and try to rebuild their lives following the long-running conflict, many residents complain they are still not able to access clean drinking water. Charlton Doki just returned from Pibor, where he spoke to the residents about their struggle to look for clean drinking water.
After walking for nearly an hour, Konyi Korok is sweating profusely from the midday sun as she finally arrives at Pibor's only underground water pump. Before she fills her 20-liter jerrican, which is what most residents here use to collect water, Korok accepts a drink from a smaller plastic container from a woman standing nearby. The water pump, powered by a generator, pumps water from underground into a metallic tank raised about 10 meters from the ground. There are a couple of taps around the tank from which residents, mostly women, fetch water for their families. Speaking in Murle, Korok says, getting enough clean water for her family's daily needs is a big challenge.
Ideally, I need 20 jerry cans of water per day because there is a lot we use it for. My husband has to use it to bathe. We also need to wash clothes for everyone at home. We also need to cook food and to wash utensils using the same water.
Unfortunately, Korok says, she is only able to fetch 2 jerry cans of water per day. And she only has 2 20-liter containers in which to store her water. That means even if she had the time and energy to fetch more water per day, she would have nowhere to store it. As a result, she walks to and from the water pump several times a day to obtain the water she needs.
When I take one jerry can like this, it gets finished almost immediately because my children will use the water to bathe. We use the same water to drink and we use the same to wash our clothes. So it gets finished immediately. Unfortunately, at home, I only have 2 jerry cans with which to fetch water. Jerry cans are very expensive in the market.
20-year-old Marco Maraka is a voluntary primary school teacher. He says NGOs have drilled 2 boreholes in Pibor, but that's not enough for the more than 10,000 residents.
The boreholes here, they are very few. They cannot even supply to all the community. Sometimes people have gone to river to fetch the water there, because when the people have come to get the water, the clean water, they are congested until they are depart to other places like river.
The river Maraka refers to is actually a man-made lake called Kengen. United Nations peacekeepers in the area dug the lake to collect stagnant water for residents. But Maraka says the water from Kengen is dirty.
People have gone to wash their clothes and the children are just defecate there. The cattle are drinking water there. And animals, the wild animals, they came to drink this water even. Everything take the water there. Like bed, what, dogs, they used to drink the water from that river. The water is not okay.
A seasonal river called Pibor used to be helpful, but it's completely dry now. Community activist Rebecca Lokale Alang says water shortages have become more severe in recent months because more people have moved into Pibor town, where they feel more secure compared to the outlying areas. Greater Pibor Administrative Area leaders say they are waiting for the national government in Juba to allocate money for the area so local officials can begin providing basic services like clean drinking water to residents. Repeated calls to water ministry officials in Juba regarding this story went unanswered. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
For the first time since South Sudan became an independent nation in 2011, the University of Juba held the graduation ceremony. Mungome Davis Rakaringe was at the university when some 3,000 students from the classes of 2013 and 14 were handed their degrees and diplomas by President Kiir.
By virtue of the authority vested in me, I shall present to each candidate a certificate of admission with the appropriate degree or diploma, and by so doing shall admit them to the rank, privileges, and responsibilities of those degrees or diplomas. I now receive the candidates for admission to the appropriate diploma.
President Kiir called yesterday's graduation ceremony historical. He says education is an important part of developing a new nation.
Our main objective in promoting higher education is to develop a human resource that has the capacity to think beyond the present, capable of analyzing its environment, and has the will to go beyond the horizons. While we welcome the new graduates in the club of employment, I encourage you to work not only in the government, but especially in the private sector, so that you can use your talent to develop this nation.
Apar Anget Simon, Awad Ali Philip, Chan Akol Akwot Chan.
Chol Makur got his bachelor's degree in medicine yesterday. He says he's eager to put his skills to work for his country.
We graduate from the College of Medicine so that the son or daughter of a poor widow in Raja County who cannot afford to pay for health care service in India can have a chance to be treated here at Juba Teaching Hospital in the Republic of South Sudan. We believe the daughter of an SPLA veteran who fought for our freedom must get quality education at Rajab Primary School and be taught by fellow graduates from College of Economics, University of Juba. We graduate from School of Law so that justice is served to all South Sudanese.
The last time anyone graduated from the University of Juba was 12 years ago. Some of the students who received their diplomas yesterday have been attending the university for about 10 years. Their studies have dragged on for so long because of strikes that will shut down the university for days and because of poor facilities.
Without light in Juba, our lecturers wake up, light their candles and prepare lessons for us. With small pay and no means of transport and poor accommodation, our lecturers still do their work very well.
Elizabeth Enoka Lubang got her master's degree in Peace and Development Studies yesterday. She says she had to juggle family responsibilities, work, and her studies for several years. But she says it was worth it in the end.
It was really very challenging to deal with the family and work as an aim at this crucial moment where South Sudan is having a lot of problems, especially in the conflict management. This experience will help me really to help my people and my community as well as South Sudan at large on how to resolve conflict amicably in a peaceful manner, not in a fighting.
Taban Loliliyong is a professor of African and English literature at the university. He served as a master of ceremonies at the graduation. Loliliyong says graduates can be proud of what they have achieved.
There is that sense of self-fulfillment. What I started it is now done. Some of them have been here for over 7 years, but it has finally been done. It convinces them that dad and mom, look, I have finished what you started doing for me some 20 years ago.
The University of Juba is the oldest university in the country. It opened in 1977, long before South Sudan existed, and has an enrollment of about 30,000 students. During the civil war in Sudan that eventually led to the birth of South Sudan, the university relocated to Khartoum. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Human Rights Watch says dozens of opponents of President Omar al-Bashir have been arrested and some of them tortured by security forces during the Sudan's just-ended elections. The international rights group's researcher for Sudan and South Sudan, Jehan Henry, says security operatives are targeting activists who were trying to organize a boycott of the presidential elections.
This whole elections period in Sudan has been marred by arrests and detentions of activists. And most of the time, it's by national security agents who are picking people, you know, sometimes off the street, sometimes while driving, sometimes in front of universities. And they're holding them in detention and then releasing them a few days later.
The last time I spoke with Human Rights Watch about the situation in Sudan, and I also spoke to the Sudanese Information Minister, Ahmed Bilal, who told me that organizations like yours and others that are advocating for human rights are fabricating stories about what is happening in Sudan. He says Sudan has laws, and if anybody breaks the laws, they have to face the consequences.
Well, that doesn't really tell us anything about what's going on right now, and it also doesn't mean that Sudanese authorities are not breaking their own laws. The other thing to keep in mind here is the National Security Act allows the national security agents very wide powers to arrest people and lock them up for 4.5 months without any judicial review. This law is itself against human rights norms.
How credible are these reports that you're getting from civil society and activists on the ground? Are they not just against the government because they hate it?
Now, in terms of the credibility of the reports, the work that we do involves speaking to eyewitnesses, fact-checking, triple-checking, finding multiple sources. It's not based on the media reports, and we would not be able to get behind research if we had doubts about its veracity. So we're certainly, you know, aware of the political dynamics inside Sudan, and we certainly take all of that into consideration when we do our fact-finding.
And how many people have been arrested so far?
Well, we don't really know, but the Sudanese monitoring, there's a solidarity committee that is tracking detentions closely that told me the other day about 38 people were still in detention. But because people get arrested and then released quickly and they don't always share their story with their colleagues or with any organization, you know, it's very difficult to know.
We have been talking about these issues in Sudan, human rights violation, for quite a long time. Sudan has been going away with it. I mean, year in, year out, nothing happens. We are hearing the same stories. What is the way forward?
It is very difficult for people who care about Sudan, people watching Sudan, involved in Sudan, to feel like we're making progress on the human rights front. I think that we are in a place where the best way that we can use our energy on Sudan is to just keep putting the violations on record and to keep the information coming out. The political quagmire that has been blocking progress in Sudan for so many years, you know, since before the CPA, after the CPA, since after the separation of South Sudan, this is something that, you know, we can't, I can't offer you a solution, a political solution. You know, I mean, I the mediators, people involved in the political talks, are working on that, are a better place to do that. All I can say is that it's pretty obvious that it's not working and, you know, that Sudan is getting away with it, just as you said.
That's Jehan Henry, Human Rights Watch researcher for Sudan and South Sudan. She was speaking to me from New York earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nigeria says it released dozens of kidnapped women and girls, but are they any of the Chibok? That story is when we come back.
On Thursday, April 30th, VOA hosts a town hall-style meeting to discuss the South Sudan peace process. Moderator John Tanza and VOA's panel of guests will discuss what has been the role of the media, the involvement of the international community, how the peace process was conducted, and has it been inclusive enough? Join us for this event live on April 30th from 1800 to 1930 UTC by visiting voanews.com/South Sudan and clicking on the live web link. We welcome your participation with comments and questions. Email us at southsudan@voanews.com or you can tweet at VOA South Sudan. What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you listen to songs in other languages? Why or why not?
Yes, I like listening to songs in other language because it helps you to learn more. It helps you to know rhythms of other languages.
I like them very much. Why? Because I think it's good to promote your culture, your uniqueness, your way of presenting music, your way of presenting issues through music. It's good to listen to such things as opposed to, with due respect, the Western ideas. That is them. That is their culture.
Yes, I listen to music in other languages. I listen to West African music, Senegal, from Senegal. Still, I listen to German music, and still, I listen to French music. Still, I listen to Spanish music, but it's not an obligation that I know these languages.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some of the thousands of migrants from Africa making the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean to Europe are young boys and girls. Some are sent across the sea by their families to find work. Others are orphans or fleeing war. Henry Ridgewell is following the migrant trail through Europe and reports for VOA from a shelter in southern Italy.
Like many teenage boys, they dream of playing football for perhaps Barcelona or Chelsea. On the grounds of their temporary new home, a large old farmhouse in the mountains of Sicily, they practice for hours every day. Officially, they're called unaccompanied minors. All the boys living here made the deadly journey across the Mediterranean alone, with no parents or relatives. Alassane from Ivory Coast made his voyage in the depths of winter. He says 15 people died on the boat. I saw my best friend die in my arms, he says, because it was so cold, so freezing. He hadn't eaten anything. We were lost at sea. 17-year-old Ivorian Wata Ali was orphaned as a boy. He and his older brother moved around looking for work, first to Burkina Faso, then to Libya, where they got caught up in the civil war. He says his brother went out to work every day. He would come home now and then to eat and then go back to work. Then one day he didn't come back. Ali says he and a friend decided to go to Italy. They saved their money and got on the boat. Daniel Cotugno runs the refugee centre in the hilltop town of Caltagirone. He says when the boys arrive, their state of mind is terrible because they are traumatized. They have passed through Libya, where they have experienced extreme violence. When they face certain death in Libya, they prefer to choose the risk of the sea journey, where there is a possibility of surviving. To many of the boys, Cotugno serves as a father figure.
Mi rendo conto che sono pochi quelli che hanno veramente già in mente.
He says very few of them have a clear idea about their next steps. And with time, talking to them, their needs start to become clear as teenagers, just like Italian teenagers, to become football players, to study, to work, so they can help their parents in their country. But a lot of their parents or brothers were killed. The boys are free to come and go, leave the shelter if they wish to, but many choose to stay and find out if they'll be resettled by the Italian government so they can start rebuilding their lives. Shaidu from Gambia says he's very grateful for the help but is keen to move on.
I'm in this camp about 4 months now, but thank God. But I would like to move in this camp to go to the community so that I can know how I will build my future tomorrow.
The boys' status as unaccompanied minors gives them a better chance of being allowed to stay in Europe. Until that decision is made, this hilltop home offers safety and an opportunity to stop a while on their journey to find a better life. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Caltagirone, Italy.
From Italy, we move to Nigeria, where the government says it has rescued nearly 300 girls and women from a Boko Haram stronghold in the country's northeast. It remains unclear if any of them are among the more than 200 missing Chibok schoolgirls kidnapped last year by the Islamist militant group. Chris Stein reports that two military spokesmen are at odds over the possibility of the rescued girls being from Chibok.
The military announced on Twitter that it had rescued 200 girls and 93 women from three camps in the Sambisa Forest. It couldn't confirm whether any girls in the group were from Chibok. The forest is thought to be one of Boko Haram's last strongholds in northeastern Nigeria, and the military earlier this month announced it would be storming Sambisa as part of its campaign against the radical Islamist group. At its peak, Boko Haram-controlled parts of the northeastern states of Borno, Yobe, and Adamawa, and carried out kidnappings in towns and villages in Nigeria and neighboring Cameroon. But last year's raid on Chibok was the most notorious episode. In that instance, militants stormed a northeastern town in the dead of night and made off the dormitory full of schoolgirls. Some escaped, but 219 remain missing. Military spokesman Major General Chris Olukulade says the military is still fighting for control of the forest.
The mission is still continuing. In fact, we have not cleared all the identified camps. We have camps that were identified in the intelligence that must be taken out.
Hogo Bitris is the chairman of Chibok Elders Forum and a representative of the families of the missing girls from Chibok. He said one of the families he spoke with had been cautiously optimistic about the news.
When we're able to ascertain that some of them are Chibok girls, then we can start rejoicing.
The families have reason to be skeptical. There have been several false alarms about the girls' release. Right after the kidnapping, the military erroneously said most had been rescued. Last September, the military said a group had been found, only to backtrack several hours later. In New York, the United Nations Special Envoy for Global Education, Gordon Brown, said the rescue of 200 girls, wherever they come from, is welcome news. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A new report says worldwide working conditions for the news media have fallen sharply to their lowest point in more than 10 years. The study says journalists are facing more restrictions from governments, militants, criminals and owners of the media. VOA correspondent Meredith Buell has details.
You can buy a newspaper nearly everywhere. Or check out the latest headlines on your smartphone. And while the news may be easy to access, journalists are finding themselves in courtrooms, behind bars, intimidated, even silenced, according to a report by the independent watchdog organization, Freedom House. Vice President for Analysis, Vanessa Tucker.
Unfortunately, the news is very bad. Press freedom suffered a global decline in 2014. It's worse the worst decline in a decade. Things are getting bad, and they're getting bad even faster than they have in the past.
According to Freedom of the Press 2015, Mexico intimidated journalists and passed a controversial communications law. While much of North America was rated as having a free press, much of Latin America was either partially free or not free. And the United States was criticized for the rough treatment of journalists by police during protests in Ferguson, Missouri. In the Asia-Pacific region, only 5% of the population had access to free media, while the rest were split evenly between partly free or not free. China's score was the worst since the 1990s, as authorities jailed journalists and tightened control over media outlets.
One of the areas that we noted that's a real problem globally and regionally right now is the impact of actors like China on their neighbors. So we saw that actions that China took had a negative impact, of course, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, and some of the other neighboring countries.
In Syria, the brutal civil war created grave dangers for journalists. The report says just 2% of people in the Middle East and North Africa live in free media environments, while the vast majority live in countries labeled not free. In sub-Saharan Africa, only 3% of the population is exposed to information from free media. More than half of the press is partly free, and nearly 40% are not free. The Freedom House report says the Eurasia region's average score remained the worst in the world. More than 80% of the media was judged as not free, and less than 20% partly free. In Russia, the report says there was a crackdown on independent voices inside the country and in neighboring nations.
One of the big areas of troubling impact that we saw was in propaganda. So completely fabricated propaganda such that people inside of Russia have essentially no idea what's going on in conflicts like that in Ukraine.
Freedom House says the growing threats to the media are a stark challenge to democratic values around the globe. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
On Thursday, April 30th, VOA hosts a town hall-style meeting to discuss the South Sudan peace process. Moderator John Tanza and VOA's panel of guests will discuss what has been the role of the media, the involvement of the international community, how the peace process was conducted, and has it been inclusive enough? Join us for this event live on April 30th from 1800 to 1930 UTC by visiting voanews.com/South Sudan and clicking on the live web link. We welcome your participation with comments and questions. Email us at southsudan@voanews.com or you can tweet at VOA South Sudan.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Survival by Bob Marley.
How can you be sitting there telling me that you care? That you care? When every time I look around, the people suffer in the suffering.
We have been listening to Bob Marley with the song Survival. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.